And we're going to go first this morning to our political correspondent, Micheál Lehane. We have new figures showing arrivals through Dublin Airport last week were up 10%, and returning from holiday was one of the top reasons given by residents coming into the country. New legislation putting mandatory hotel quarantine in place has been passed by the Oireachtas and is due to be signed into law by President Higgins. Micheál, good morning. To start with these new figures coming in, a survey of passengers arriving in a one-week period between the 22nd and the 28th of February. What do they tell us?
Yeah, they tell us that they were up on the previous week, about 10,000 the previous week. Then the last week in February, they're up at over 11,000, 10% increase, as you said. And then the big reason given for the over 7,000 Irish residents who are returning into the country through Dublin Airport is that they were abroad for holiday reasons or visiting reasons. Other reasons for coming to the country include visiting a sick relative or for medical reasons. But the big one, holidaying, and I think that will probably raise some eyebrows. Of course, the legislation that deals with mandatory hotel quarantine is also going to include a provision to increase the fine from €500 to €2,000 for non-essential foreign travel. But that's not law yet, but it is set to become law quite soon. The figures and the detailed breakdown also show that people coming into the country, primarily they're Irish residents, over 7,000 or so. Then those that aren't are coming from places like Britain, Spain, Poland and Romania.
Crucially, is there any information if they are coming from these red zone countries, as they're called, or if they had transited through these countries? Is that sort of information provided?
Yeah, that information isn't provided, but of course there is a system in place now, and that's what the fact that this data is being picked up at Dublin Airport would suggest that if someone from the red zone or the 33 listed countries were to come through, that they would have to observe a period of mandatory quarantine, an extensive one beyond others. But I suppose what the opposition will point to is that system of hotel mandatory quarantine that still isn't up and running. And when the Cabinet, as I understand it, discussed it this week, there wasn't an exact date given as to when those hotels will be there and ready to receive people. But the sense and the clear sense talking to several sources was that that needs to happen within the next fortnight.
So no date, no exact date for when it's going to take off. But information emerging last night, Micheál, about the use of the army in either securing or transporting individuals who would be going into hotel quarantining.
Yeah, from what I know, as those plans are being drawn up at the moment, the Defence Forces will have a key role to play, not in the everyday running of the hotels, that'll be done by a private security firm. But when it comes to things like transport, moving the people from the airport to the hotels, it's likely the Defence Forces would have a big role there. Also, getting the hotels ready, essentially, the Army's logistical skills there and ability to set up a camp quickly will be used. And the IT system, the computer system that will underpin the entire process, that's also likely to involve the Defence Forces. So you can see the plans beginning to take shape, but some of those involve still using words like operationally challenging. So it will take a little bit of time yet, but 2 weeks seen as at least the political deadline that's been set for this, although that is an informal one, I understand.
The parliamentary party meetings last night, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and criticism, I think, at both meetings of the slow pace of vaccine rollout, and criticism too at the Fine Gael meeting at the Tánaiste, having a cut off the Green Party TD Patrick Costello over these High Court proceedings he's initiating around this CETA agreement, the agreement between Canada and the European Union. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, as reported from the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party, fairly strong words from the Tánaiste about the action that Patrick Costello is taking in the courts. The Tánaiste understood to have said this was far worse than actually voting against the legislation or the proposal in the Dáil, because it was taking a court action by a member of government who was in that government, and saying too that not everyone in Fine Gael had an appetite for joining the coalition, but they would never contemplate taking any court action against it. I think that is illustrative of the kind of tensions that exist on that CETA agreement proposal, which is slowly beginning to make its way through the Oireachtas following an unsuccessful attempt to do that fairly swiftly late last year. But it shows there's some way to travel on it. And I suppose it does raise the question as to how will government relations sit at the end of that process. You still think there is a majority numbers within the House to get it passed whenever it does make it to the floor after going through committee first. But what will the impact be on government at the end of it? Also at the parliamentary party meetings, for the first time really, fairly sustained and at times stinging criticism of the vaccine rollout programme, taken on board by the Taoiseach, who said he had spoken to the HSE about the need for what was termed proper communication and perhaps the possibility of setting up a direct line to allow for queries on the vaccine to be dealt with and also to assist GPs. But several TDs in both parties expressing concern about the inability of some GPs to still get vaccines to administer to the over 85s, and also concern too about the fact that targets have been missed.
And very briefly, Micheál, was the government taken completely by surprise yesterday with the British move on the grace periods on trade within the protocol?
Yeah, I think the language from the government's fairly strong on that last night. The Taoiseach describing it as being unhelpful and also urging the British to get back and negotiate with the European Union at the joint committee level, but also saying too that unilateral actions like this undermine the trust necessary to reach agreements. So strong words there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Micheál Lehan, our political correspondent. Thank you very much.
And as Micheál was saying, the Taoiseach says he's disappointed. The Minister for Foreign Affairs has described the move as deeply unhelpful. And as you heard Tony Connolly reporting earlier, EU officials are furious at the British government's announcement that it would extend the period that it would move goods to Northern Ireland without Brexit paperwork beyond an agreed grace period without the agreement of the EU. More stringent checks were due to be introduced next month. We'll hear from Simon Coveney later and EU Commissioner Mairead McGuinness shortly, but first let's hear from businesses in the north. Eoin Connolly, Director of the Northern Ireland Retail Consortium, says he welcomes the move, but he told our reporter Éilidh Sheehy that a long-term workable solution is needed.
We need a trusted trader scheme. We need something that provides simplicity. So the first thing we need is digitization. That would mean that instead of having lots of pieces of paper, we have one or none. And that digitization also can help the EU see where things are going. And that then leads us to evidence that's needed for a trusted trader scheme that removes a lot of that friction altogether. And then, of course, we need a veterinary agreement to allow things to flow.
Now, are you optimistic that problems that exist now can be overcome and can be dealt with?
I'm always the optimist, but we have to be pragmatic and realistic about this as well. We really need for this extension of the grace period to be used to get a new system of trade in place. Now, this was done unilaterally. It is not the way we would have wanted it done. We would have wanted it done bilaterally with the EU. However, the principle still remains. That principle that was set out on the 8th of December by the EU and the UK, that Northern Ireland needed these grace periods until a new system was in place. That new system is not in place, therefore we still need those grace periods. And we hope that the EU will show a generosity of spirit. Even if that happens, it's quite a short time to get a new trading system up and ready. What we can say is that Northern Ireland business will not be found lacking. We will continue to use our best endeavours to make this work. We need the EU and the UK to live up to their commitments in the preamble of the protocol, which said they would do all of this with the least disruption possible to Northern Ireland communities.
That's Eoin Connolly, Director of the Northern Ireland Retail Consortium. Let's speak to Mairead McGuinness, EU Commissioner for Financial Stability, Financial Services and the Capital Markets Union. Mairead McGuinness, good morning.
Good morning.
Is it the Commission's view that the British government is breaking international law here?
Yes, it is. And I think it's not the first time, unfortunately, that this has happened. I think that what Eoin has just said is absolutely true. We need solutions for business in Northern Ireland. And we were working on those in the joint committee. So it is more than, I wouldn't say surprise, it's disappointment that we have issued the statement, because unilaterally the United Kingdom is negotiating with itself a solution rather than negotiating with the European Union. And, you know, the response from member states echoes what the Taoiseach has said here. We need trust in order to make progress. And unfortunately, when things are done unilaterally and not done through the proper channels, then trust is lacking. And that makes it very difficult to get proper solutions in place. And the other point is that we are also in the process of ratifying the trade and cooperation agreement that's going through the European Parliament. And we had hoped there would be dates date, or agreed date, perhaps today, I'm not sure how the Parliament will look at this particular move. And while the UK painted as simply technical and, you know, to get over a problem, it's very, very unusual that you would be in negotiations with a partner and then you would step outside and make a decision that impacts on your partner without having a discussion about it. So I think we need to separate the need for a solution. That's absolutely clear for Northern Ireland and to get the protocol working. But the manner of its being is certainly not appropriate, okay, will cause difficulties, and we need to be able to say that very clearly.
If the Commission believes that Britain is breaking international law here, what's it going to do in response?
There is no decision today as to what will be done because we're looking in detail. There is a dispute resolution mechanism, as you know. There are other ways and many ways of dealing with this. But I think a clear message has got to go to the United Kingdom that we spent a long time reaching an agreement on the protocol. We agreed absolutely in December that there were a need for grace periods. My colleague, Vice President Sefcovic, worked so hard on this and indeed was working yesterday on this to try and get a movement so that we could give the certainty to business that it needs and also address issues for member states. So work was ongoing. There is no lack of will on our side. Okay. And I think what is interesting now is that we will have to sit down together. So the talks will continue. There is no way that they cannot continue, but they certainly continue in a more difficult atmosphere than prior to this decision. As I said, the manner of its communication was also unusual, but clearly it does speak to problems that business have in Northern Ireland. And I want to say very clearly that the European Union wants to address those problems which were created by Brexit and the form of Brexit that the British Prime Minister pursued. So we are trying to solve a problem we didn't create.
Yes.
And yesterday's development adds further difficulty to the problem solving.
Will you take legal action?
As I say, I will not be making that decision,
no,
but
will,
there are
the
all sorts of options.
Action?
As you know, the last time around when this occurred, an infringement proceeding was issued. That decision has not been taken in relation to the very recent news, but there are possibilities. On the other hand, we all know that Brexit has not helped relationships. We have got to move on and deal with the realities, help people and businesses. But we also need to make sure that there is mutual respect. And that when we have an agreement or and are in negotiation, that one partner doesn't leave the room and decide it's going to do its own thing. Could you imagine this morning if the European Union had taken such an approach and walked outside the negotiations and made a decision? We don't do that and we wouldn't do that. So I think we have to be able to say, you know, tough things to our friends in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
But equally, we will continue to talk because it is in all of our interest to make sure that the withdrawal agreement and the protocol work.
Is the Commission considering legal action either on the basis of infringement of the treaty or because the British government didn't use the arbitration mechanism? Is that move being considered?
I think the Commission is looking very closely at what was done yesterday and trying to make the appropriate response. And I think the statement yesterday from Vice President Sefcovic is strong because clearly he has said that what has happened undermines the work of the Joint Committee and the mutual trust needed to find solutions. That's a very strong statement from somebody who has tirelessly worked to try and make the protocol effective. So I think from that point of view, the mood is certainly a difficult one. I think member states will be wondering why the United Kingdom would have taken this unilateral action when we were negotiating. So I think there will be a measured response. And equally, we will be, if you like, the adults in the room here. There's work to be done and we have to get on with it, despite this particular development, which is most unhelpful.
You heard from Aon Connolly there representing many businesses in the north, and he's not alone. Why not simply extend the grace period?
Well, look, I know Aidan from dealing with him when I was a member of the European Parliament, and he is solutions oriented, as we are. And remember that in December, we did agree an extension and we were in the process of negotiating a possible extension with other issues to try and solve problems for businesses in Northern Ireland. I suppose the one concern I would have that there are voices in Northern Ireland who don't want a solution. They want trouble or difficulties. They don't want the protocol. And I think we have to be very clear that Brexit, the vote was in 2016. We've all worked very hard day and night to make things better than they might be otherwise, even though every time we negotiate with Brexit, it is a lose-lose for everyone. But I want to be clear that the European Union is fully aware of the difficulties in Northern Ireland. will respond appropriately. But the best way to do that is around the table. It's interesting that Lord Frost has just come on board, and he will be the counterpart to my colleague, Vice President Stefkovic. And I think it's not the best start to any relationship. But unfortunately, we will have to deal with the situation as it is today and perhaps separate out the political realities of how the UK perhaps operates, which we don't think is entirely appropriate, and the practical realities for businesses on the ground. So we will still be looking for solutions here, but we'll do it with the United Kingdom,
when you say it's
not without them.
Yes, when you say it's interesting that this move comes after Lord Frost has taken over as the British counterpart to Commissioner Shevkovich, do you believe that it's connected to his appointment, to his involvement in these negotiations?
I think it's just an observation of a fact. I know that Vice President Stefkovic...
What do you mean by it being interesting?
And Michael Gove had a very good relationship. I think that Marat Shevkovic also wants a very strong relationship with David Frost. The time hasn't been available to do that, but even despite yesterday, it's going to have to happen. I mean, there is nobody more willing and able than the EU side to get over problems and difficulties. But equally, I think we have to be very clear that when something happens that is not appropriate, and indeed, in our view, breaches both trust and an international agreement, then we have to call it out. And it does open a question mark about Global Britain, if this is how Global Britain would negotiate with other partners. I mean, our experience has been not an easy one, to put it mildly. So it wasn't a good day yesterday. And this morning, we have to face the facts and the realities, and we have to work for practical solutions with the United Kingdom, not separately. I mean, we will never get the right solution if the two parties do not agree collectively on the way forward.
EU Commissioner Mairead McGuinness, thank you.
The Programme for Government raised the target for renewable on offshore energy as part of the drive to reach 70% of renewable power by 2030 under the Climate Action Plan. Plans for hundreds of wind turbines along the Irish Sea coast are already at an advanced stage, but there are concerns for what the scale of the plans might mean for coastal bird life. In the second of our series on the country's power infrastructure, our economics correspondent looks at Ireland. Ireland's offshore power plans.
Look out from spots like Bray Head and you may notice ships conducting surveys. They're part of the planning for offshore wind farms like the Dublin Array, one of several on the east coast. Peter Lefroy is its project manager.
We're very sensitive to those concerns, and we recognise that people have concerns about the visual impact that this project will have. But what I would say is that this project will be located over 10 kilometres from shore. And to put that in a terrestrial context, the minimum distance from an onshore turbine to a house is 500 metres. This project will be over 20 times that distance to shore.
Five proposed offshore wind farms along the east coast are already at an advanced stage of planning. They stretch from 25 turbines planned by Park Wind and the ESB off Dundalk to an area northeast of Lambay Island, where Norwegian company Statkraft plan to site 30 turbines. Dublin Array, led by German group RWE, could see between 46 and 61 turbines on the Kish and Bray banks. Further south on the Codling Bank, a joint Norwegian-French consortium is planning what could be Ireland's biggest offshore wind farm with up to 140 turbines. And off Arklow, SSE plan an additional 76 turbines. The scale of the combined plans has raised concerns about its impact on coastal bird life. Una Duggan is head of advocacy with Birdwatch Ireland.
If you have a bird that has to go further, if its habitat for foraging is displaced by a wind farm, then it'll have to travel further and you have hungry chicks on a nest. And over time, that could have impacts on breeding success and on the populations.
In towns along the coast, some see the wind farms as an economic opportunity. Alpha Marine already supplies vessels to service SSE's turbines off Arklow. Tim Greenwood is its commercial director.
We've coastal communities along the east coast, and they really could do with a lift. There's some people who are really always looking out towards the sea, and I think that a young person standing on the quay, seeing nice vessels going in and out to the wind farm, they can go, oh, that's lovely, I'd love a piece of that. Maybe that's a career for me. Maybe there's a good job in this new industry in offshore wind and seafaring.
However, the granting of a survey licence for work on the Arklow project is being challenged in the courts, an indication perhaps of choppy waters ahead for offshore energy.
Our economics correspondent Robert Short reporting there. Coming up now to 20 minutes to 8. And as we've been hearing, passenger numbers through Dublin Airport increased by more than 10% last week. And returning from holiday was listed among the top reasons for arrivals into the country. Legislation enabling mandatory hotel quarantining has passed all stages in the Oireachtas now. It's due to be signed into law by President Higgins, but having it up and running is probably still a couple of weeks away. Darren O'Rourke is Sinn Féin transport spokesman. Good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
Now, the numbers coming into the airport are low. It's just over 11,000, which is significantly over 90% down on the types of numbers you'd normally expect. But of 7,000 resident arrivals, a big number said they were coming back from holiday. Are you surprised?
Well, I'm disappointed, but not overly surprised, Mary. And of course, it's important to point out that the risk isn't a relative risk compared to last year or the year before. It's a real risk. So every person coming through the airport is a potential risk. It's very clear from the figures that the level of non-essential travel remaining is far too high. It's far higher than it should be. And it's hugely frustrating for people who are making such sacrifices here. People can't travel 5 kilometres from their home. They can't attend family funerals. Their businesses are closed. We have situations where children with special educational needs are still at home. There's huge sacrifices being made here on the island, and people are very, very frustrated and angry, in my experience, when they see the level of discretionary travel that's allowed to take place.
What would you do with them? A big majority here coming home, they have to fill out the locator forms. They have to abide by strict rules around testing and restricting their movements.
Well, I don't think anybody has any confidence that all of those people coming into the country through the ports and airports will strictly adhere to the quarantine regimes that are in place there from the government. We know that there isn't adequate follow-up either on the passenger locator form or on the voluntary quarantine regime at home. And to be honest, Mary, I think this is an inevitable outworking of the government's half-baked approach to international travel. I think there's a clear signal from government that they're not serious about introducing a strict regime of mandatory hotel quarantine for all non-essential arrivals, like is the practically across the board request from the opposition and from the vast majority of the public. And when people see those indicators and when they see the lack of enforcement, they get a clear indication from government that there are loopholes, there are gaps, there are opportunities there, and some people will take those. So, and it's really, really frustrating for people.
I just want to be clear. Are you saying that everyone that came in through Dublin Airport of that 11,000, that you would subject all of them, if it were in place, to mandatory hotel quarantining, and everybody who travels, comes into the country through Northern Ireland and travels to the Republic, would you put them all in?
So the point is in relation to essential and non-essential, Mary, that there needs to be a strict definition in relation to essential travel. Because we need the island to maintain strategic connectivity, we need to maintain essential supplies. But outside of that, the discretionary element of travel should not be happening in the middle of a global pandemic where we have virus and variants and vaccine widespread in the community. It's a really important time in our response to the pandemic, and it's really important that we take the strongest possible measures at this point in time. And the government aren't going far enough despite the calls from across the board.
I take your point about this non-essential travel, but are you saying that in relation to the 11,000 who arrived in that week up to last Sunday, that you would believe they should all have been subject to a mandatory hotel quarantining?
So what we would need to do there is define and triage the people coming in terms of whether they were essential travellers or non-essential travellers. But every one of them that was a non-essential traveller would need to spend a fortnight in mandatory hotel quarantine based on the proposals of Sinn Féin and others, including public health officials. And that's the type of regime that needs to be in place to act as, in the first instance, as an absolute deterrent to undertake non-essential travel.
All right, Darren O'Rourke, Sinn Féin transport spokesperson, thank you very much.
The Department of Foreign Affairs describes the humanitarian crisis in Yemen as the worst in the world, with 20 million people in need of assistance. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that Yemen is now in imminent danger of the worst famine the world has seen for decades. BBC international correspondent Orla Geerin has been reporting from Yemen in recent weeks.
Many teachers in Yemen haven't been paid their government salaries in years. At this school, some don't turn up anymore. In one of the classrooms, we find a substitute. Ahmed Raghib, a 9-year-old in a blue shirt, is taking the class. We're told he's the best student in the school. He's full of character, with a ready smile, and he has been blind from birth.
We caught up with Orla Geerin within the last hour, and she told us more about life in Yemen for Ahmed and his classmates.
Well, it's hard to overstate how extreme the needs are in Yemen, even before the conflict began, or before the conflict escalated, and that's 6 years ago now. This was already the poorest country in the Arab world. What has happened since then during these long years of war is that basically the economy has collapsed, the currency has collapsed, food prices have risen by about 140%. So people who were struggling before really have no resources now. And one of the casualties of the war that we looked at on this trip is education. One in five schools across the country are out of use, and about 500,000 children are out of school because of the conflict. But we were told about a school where people, where students were being taught in incredible conditions, and we were told that this was basically a shell. So we thought we were prepared for what we were going to see. But when we came around the corner that morning, myself and my colleagues, and actually saw the building, everybody's jaw hit the ground. It's very hard to capture in words exactly how bad the state of the place is. The building is basically a kind of a latticework of crumbling masonry, but several hundred children arrive every morning. They gather in the schoolyard, they have morning assembly, and then they file into the rubble and literally sit down in the ruins. I mean, there are no walls, there are no chairs, no doors, no floors. It looks completely unsafe. As we were standing there, and there are children in the upper story of this building, we were actually saying to ourselves, is it even safe for them to be upstairs? But this is where they study. This is all they have. And the headmistress said to us, look, we have two terrible choices here. We can either teach in these conditions, or we can deny this generation an education. So we choose to carry on with the danger. And this is a school that is in a frontline area. While we were filming there, we could hear gunfire in the distance, and our main interviewee, Ahmed, who is a wonderful 9-year-old boy who I think has really touched hearts around the world, as we were filming with him, he responded to the sound of gunfire. And Ahmed is remarkable in many ways. He is a stand-in teacher at the school. When teachers don't turn up, he gives classes. And he has been blind from birth, but he is an extraordinarily resilient young boy.
And then we have the kind of scale of child mortality that exists in Yemen at the moment. Every 10 minutes, a child dying from disease in the country. Given the scale of the humanitarian crisis there, Orla, why do you think the UN donor conference failed earlier this week with pledges of just over 1.3 billion euro, less than half the nearly 4 billion needed to finance this year's life-saving programs?
And the aid promised this year is less than the aid promised last year and less than the aid promised the year before. I mean, I think the UN is up against a few factors. Undoubtedly, the global pandemic has had a disastrous effect on economies around the world. It has made governments think about their priorities. For many, it may be easier to cut aid at a distance, cut support for people far away than cut programs in their own country. I think there is also, terrible as it is to say it, I think there is also international fatigue with Yemen. The conflict is about to enter its seventh year. It has become one of those intractable features of the international landscape. And I think there is another important factor, which is that an awful lot of the suffering and the humanitarian need in Yemen is basically hidden from view. It's extremely hard to go there. I mean, many international organizations, not just the BBC, are committed to trying to cover that story. You need to plough in an awful lot of time. This was my sixth trip to the country since the conflict escalated in 2015, but this trip actually took almost 2 years to arrange. So I think it's a combination of things, but it's, you know, it's impossible to overstate how much aid is needed. This really is a matter of life and death, and it's life or death soon. The UN has been warning for months that there is a danger, an imminent danger of famine on a scale the world hasn't seen for decades. It has said Yemen is falling off a cliff. It has said there is a danger of people starving. In fact, it says 2.6 million people are currently a step away from famine. Now, these are words the UN doesn't use lightly and the international aid community doesn't use lightly. There is a very technical definition to be met for famine. But definitely that's on the horizon as far as the UN is concerned. So aid is needed.
Orla, you've reported from several conflicts in your career. How does this one compare? And were you worried for you and your crew's safety while you were reporting there?
No, we didn't have safety concerns. And I have to say this time the situation on the ground was more quiet, if I can put it that way, than during previous trips. So we were not in any sense really worried for ourselves. I mean, we were in some frontline areas, including in the city of Taiz. But the great risk in these places is always for the civilians who are living there day in and day out. One of the reasons we went to Taiz, which is almost a besieged city, is that we had heard about children who were being deliberately targeted by Houthi snipers. And we went and we met children, including a remarkable little girl who was shot in the head and survived, who was deliberately targeted by a sniper. So the risks in these areas are always for defenseless civilians, for women and children. And in that situation in Taiz in particular, there have been hundreds of attacks in recent years, literally hundreds of attacks documented by local human rights workers, where children have been deliberately targeted by snipers. And these are the kind of stories that generally don't tend to be told because people can't get in to report on the real horror of what is happening in Yemen.
BBC International Correspondent Orla Geeran.
Deeply unhelpful. That's Minister Simon Coveney's reaction to yesterday's move by the British government to unilaterally change the Northern Ireland Protocol by extending the temporary grace periods in place to help companies adapt to new trading arrangements. The European Commission called it a violation of the protocol and is considering legal action. This follows last year's threat by the British government to break international law, and more recently, the EU's move quickly rescinded to override the agreement in relation to COVID vaccine supplies. Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney, good morning and thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
So, you know, we have Britain acting unilaterally here. We have the EU responding with threats of legal action. How toxic are relations right now between the two?
Well, I mean, I think relations had been improving, and that's why yesterday's actions by the British government are just so frustrating from my perspective, because the Irish government has really been in the middle of trying to ensure that the relationship between the EU and the UK improved in the context of the protocol. We've been very active in terms of ensuring that the Commission understands the complexity of politics in Northern Ireland and why many people feel offended by the protocol, and that's why we needed to find a way of showing some flexibility in terms of some of the genuine concerns in relation to implementation of the protocol since the 1st of January. So the relationship between Maros Sefcovic, who's the Vice President of the Commission, and the person on the EU side who is trying to ensure the protocol is implemented properly, and until a few days ago, Michael Gove, who was the senior UK minister, trying to do that. Those two men had a very good relationship, were working through the issues, were listening to people in Northern Ireland, and had agreed only 10 days ago to interact with business leaders in Northern Ireland again in a lot more detail to really understand where there are problems and how they could be solved. And, of course, we had a joint committee and a specialised committee, which is the committee infrastructure, if you like, to deal with these issues in partnership, the UK and the EU working together to to solve genuine problems.
Yeah, and that's a lot of committees and meetings and so on. Yeah. But for business, and we heard from them earlier, they are trying to move ahead with business. Is the factor here, is the difficulty here, as you say, you haven't mentioned him by name, but the new replacement to Michael Gove, is the difficulty David Frost?
Well, I mean, the difficulty is that the British government has changed their approach. And unfortunately, what this means is that the EU, I think, certainly see, and this is not the first time this has happened, that they are negotiating with a partner that they simply can't trust. And that's why the EU is now looking at legal options and legal action, which effectively means a much more formalized and rigid negotiation process, as opposed to a process of partnership, where you try to solve problems together. And so this is really unwelcome. It's the British government essentially breaking the protocol, breaking their own commitments again, and the EU having to then consider how they respond to that, while at the same time ensuring that in practical terms the protocol can be implemented. So, you know, ironically, some of the things that the British government have now unilaterally decided to announce, the Irish government has been advocating for in Brussels, and in my view, we were making progress on. But the way in which the British government has done this, which essentially is to ignore the commitments that they've made, the relationships that they have built with the EU side, and instead to make decisions on the basis of politics in Westminster and in terms of some relationships, presumably in Northern Ireland as well, they have decided to act unilaterally, which is clearly in breach of the protocol and the commitments that have been made only a few weeks ago. I mean, don't forget, in a joint committee, in a formal statement at the end of that committee 10 days ago, the UK side committed to implementing the protocol properly, to implementing what had been agreed in December between both sides in writing, and to work together to interact with business leaders in Northern Ireland more thoroughly, to try to solve problems. And now we have, a couple of weeks later, with a new person in charge, taking a different direction, and, you know, leaving the EU with no option but to look at legal options. And don't forget, you know, the reason why this couldn't be worse in terms of timing is that today the Conference of Presidents in the European Parliament is deciding how the European Parliament is going to deal with the ratification of the trade and association agreement.
Indeed, and Mairead McGuinness referred to that a little earlier. It seems extraordinary, though, that Boris Johnson and Micheál Martin had a chat earlier this week around coming together in a spirit of cooperation to try and win a bid to host the World Cup in 2030. And nothing mentioned about this. Or was there something mentioned?
No, there was something mentioned in that conversation, but not the detail of the approach the British government would take. So Prime Minister Johnson did outline that he had concerns in relation to certain traditional products. What he's referring to is chilled meats like British sausages and so on, being able to be traded from GB into Northern Ireland. And in time, that may be problematic when grace periods end. So he has raised that issue repeatedly. But the way to resolve these issues is not to unilaterally announce something.
Minister,
it's to negotiate it and agree it with a partner that you've signed up in international law with to a protocol. And so what unfortunately is now happening is mixed signals are being given to businesses in Northern Ireland that the British government can just act unilaterally as opposed to abide by its international legal obligations to negotiate collectively to find solutions with the EU.
To just come briefly back, Minister, if you're still hearing me, to come briefly back to that conversation between the Taoiseach and the Prime Minister, and you say there were concerns expressed. Was there any heads up given that if there's no movement, and no movement by Budget Day in Britain or immediately after, that Britain would move to act unilaterally?
I'm not aware that there was. I mean, the first I heard of this I heard of it being confirmed was when I spoke to David Frost yesterday and to Brandon Lewis, who's the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. We had a blunt but detailed conversation in relation to what the British government was planning to do. I strongly advised them not to do it because I felt that this would really damage the relationship with the European Union and with Vice President Šefčovič in particular. And the relationship between Lord Frost and Vice President Šefčovič is a really important one for Ireland and for our future on this island in terms of the pragmatic implementation of the protocol and what's been agreed in international law. And before Lord Frost had even spoken in detail to Maroš Šefčovič in his new role, this was announced in a written statement by the British government in Westminster. To say that is disrespectful would be an understatement. And so now Vice President Šefčovič, who has shown a real willingness to understand the problems of the protocol in Northern Ireland where they exist and to try to solve them and to make a case for that in the European Commission and in the European Parliament and in the European Council, and was making progress on that, for him to be undermined in this way by the British government is, as I said yesterday, deeply unhelpful. And from an Irish government's perspective, because we have been advocating for flexibility.
Do you want legal action?
In terms of responding to... No, just if I could finish the point. The Irish government, who have been advocating for businesses in Northern Ireland in the context of a pragmatic and flexible implementation of the protocol within the confines of that protocol, it also undermines our credibility to be able to do this. Because, of course, the British government is effectively saying, give us what we want in terms of implementation of the protocol, or we will unilaterally decide to do it anyway.
And
you
I want
cannot
to move
base
on to,
a relationship
to
of trust on okay. that kind of approach.
I want to move on to domestic issues, but just very briefly, do you favour legal action here, or is that a last resort?
No, I don't favour legal action.
Okay.
I favour engagement, and engagement on the basis of
engagement.
Trust between both sides. But if the UK simply cannot be trusted because they take unilateral action in an unexpected way without negotiation, well, then the British government leaves the EU with no option. And this is not where we want to be, but it's where the British government is driving us towards.
Coming back to domestic matters, the mandatory hotel quarantining still not in place and still, and you might be able to give us a timeline, but we're told some weeks away. But can you tell us about the army involvement now and what their role will be?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, when you say it's still not in place, the law hasn't even been signed by the president yet. So hopefully that's going to happen now very soon because the legislation has been passed by the Oireachtas. Now needs to be signed by the president, which I understand will happen very quickly, as it always does. And then we will move to ensure that the practical arrangements are in place to have a hotel quarantine facilities managed by the state. The Defence Forces will, of course, be involved in that, just like they've been involved in virtually every step of our response to the COVID pandemic, whether that's testing, whether it's tracing, whether it's transportation, whether it's bringing test samples to labs in Germany, whether it's the vaccination rollout. We're also going to be involved in helping the HSE to ensure that mandatory quarantine works efficiently. But the structure here will be that the Department of Health has essentially tendered this work out to the private sector to run the hotels, to run the transport systems and so on. But what I've offered to do and the Defence Forces have offered to do in their role as aid to civil authority, if you like, is to essentially be the conductor of the orchestra, is the way it's been described. In other words, to manage the logistics, to have a 24/7 management centre in McKee Barracks to ensure that if there are problems, they get resolved quickly, and to make sure that they provide a supervisory role to ensure that those who are operating the contract to do this properly are doing it as has been agreed. So as ever, the Defence Forces are there to help on
just,
all
just to be a bit more clear on it.
Properly done.
So the Defence Forces act as the policeman of the private security firm, is that right?
Well, the Defence Forces are there to deal with problems if they arise, to support those who are operating the new systems that will be put in place, to support the HSE.
But not specifically involved in transporting?
No, I don't think they will be. If there is a need for them to get involved, of course they will. But they will be called in to assist if necessary. But the idea is that this full service has been tendered out by the Department of Health. And then the logistics and the coordination and the management on a day-to-day basis to make sure that that is running as it should will be taken on by the Defence Forces. And we've worked very closely with the HSC to make sure that those systems operate properly.
Reports of a lot of unease at both parliamentary party, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael parliamentary parties last night about the slow pace of rollout of the vaccine. And also, Minister, signs now coming from the EU that the sort of solidarity on the vaccine distribution that the EU wanted, that too is breaking down with countries sourcing supplies themselves and where they can.
Yeah, I mean, some countries have looked to source from outside of the European Union. Ireland will certainly not be sourcing any vaccines that aren't approved by the European Medicines Agency. A small number of countries have looked to source vaccines from Russia. And one from China, and that isn't an approach that I think we can stand over or should follow. So we're going to work, and we have been working with the European Commission to make sure that we can maximise the availability of vaccines, so that we can quickly move to 100,000 vaccines a week, and then on to over 250,000 vaccines a week.
We're still falling
far
short
as next month. Unfortunately, we have had some supply problems linked to AstraZeneca. That is certainly not the HSE's fault. In terms of rollout on a weekly basis, we will be ensuring that the only delays or restrictions in terms of the volumes of vaccine doses being rolled out are linked to international supply and nothing else.
Okay.
And our teams are working night and day to make that happen.
Right,
I was on the call for our parliamentary party meeting last night for the vast majority of it, not for the entirety of the call, mm-hmm. but for the vast majority of it. And, you know, of course people want vaccine rollouts to happen as early as it possibly can. But there was certainly no criticism of the HSE.
All right, Minister.
Or the rollout system last night.
Thank you very much for your time this morning. Minister Simon Coveney.
8:41. The Choice Music Prize, which celebrates the Irish Album of the Year, is usually announced during a live concert at Vicar Street. However, this year, of course, that can't go ahead. But organisers were determined to celebrate the best in new Irish music, so there'll be a special show later today on the Tracy Clifford Show on 2FM and live on the RTE Player. Sinead Crowley reports.
You know, it's important to appreciate where you come from, you know what I mean? Your home, like, your circle, your tight-knit, your close-knit.
Musician JLOL is one of the newer performers on this year's Choice shortlist and very happy to be there.
That's home.
It's a great feeling, especially where I received the news. I was back in Nigeria with my family and we all kind of feel like, learned about it together, so it was a crazy experience being able to be like to my dad, yo, my album just got nominated for Irish Album of the Year, and then everyone's like, oh.
Some days I want to put this city on the map, some days I want to put it in my rear view.
Also on the list is Nilo, nominated for his album All the Leaves Are Falling. He says the nomination has given him great encouragement at this stage in his career.
It's really good in a way, because to make the stuff that I make, it does take like a lot of experience of pain and you know, just stuff that you go through in your life, and to have that connect with people, especially people in the music industry.
If you're looking for your black James Bond on show, Spicebox Taxi by the Central on show. Last year's Choice Prize final was one of the last live gigs to take place in Ireland before coronavirus restrictions kicked in. But as organiser Dave Reid explains, all involved were determined it would go ahead this year in some form.
It's been such a hard year for the Irish music industry, and it's so important to keep this event going to try and promote Irish music. So yes, it was always planned to try and have some version of it, but it'll work out fine. I think it's, you know, it's like, it's live, it's good acts, so we're definitely pleased to have it on, yes.
And so instead of a live gig, the winner will be announced on this afternoon's Tracy Clifford Show on 2FM.
We've got Pillow Queens, Roisin Murphy, Nilo, JLOL, Denise Chyla, Silverbacks, their fabulous debut album. There's something for everybody in this year's 10. Fontaines DC, who are Grammy nominated. Yeah, it's a massive list. It really, really is. There's something for everybody, and I think it just showcases Irish music and the talent that we are producing from this country.
NBC, Sky News, someone call the BBC.
BBC. Everything's feeling CCTV, but don't watch, I'll give you something to see.
Oh, it's absolutely imperative that the Choice Music Prize goes ahead this year because it needs to showcase the amazing music that Ireland has produced in the crazy year of 2020. So we're not able to have the award show like we usually do in Vicar Street. We're having it on my show on 2FM between 1 and 3 today. To a place and you know you're welcome. That's home.
That's home. Home is where the heart is.
Yeah, for sure. Home is where the love is. There's a mutual respect between everyone that's been nominated and we're all just so honoured that we're in each other's company. I mean, there's it's not classified into genres, so we have music from all over the shop. So I think everyone is just conscious of the fact that we're amongst greatness and amongst excellence in each other.
Of togetherness, oath, love that never lets loath come in and never grow close, or running on parallel roads, or so the fairy tale goes. Pose when the carousel slows. Those that never tell told, love will forever melt.
Looking forward to getting to hear some of that music live eventually. That was JLOL ending that report from Sinead Crowley. The Choice Prize will be announced on 2FM later and there will also be a highlight show on RTE television next week.
Fury in Brussels, no trust, no mutual respect and threats of legal action by the EU following Britain's unilateral move to change how the Northern Ireland Protocol is implemented. Where to from here? Our Europe editor Tony Connolly joins me. Confrontation, Tony, seems the order of the day at the moment. How are they going to defuse this one?
Well, they're trying to figure that out, Mary, and I think the first thing they want to look at is what legal action they can take. And it was signalled quite clearly last night by the European Commission that they could take legal action either through the withdrawal agreement, because there's a dispute settlement mechanism in that, an arbitration process, or even through the free trade agreement, which they concluded just before Christmas. So they are looking at this very seriously. Some suggestion that they could go for an infringement proceeding as well, which is what happened initially after the Internal Market Bill was introduced last September. But politically, the damage here shouldn't be underestimated, because Maros Šefčovič, who is the EU's representative on the Joint Committee, who's been negotiating with Michael Gove initially to try and find solutions to how the protocol is implemented, he is now having to start a new relationship with David Frost, who was the chief Brexit negotiator. But it's not necessarily within his gift to simply work up solutions with the UK and then that's sorted. He has to get those solutions approved by member states. And member states, frankly, see the UK as simply weaponizing the mistake that the Commission made on Article 16 and, you know, methodically downgrading their responsibilities on the protocol. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that member states are now running out of patience with the UK and are quite unlikely to grant the kind of flexibility that Maros Šefčovič would need to cut a deal.
Yeah, and we heard earlier about a good working relationship that had developed between Michael Gove and Šefčovič. What is the relationship like between him and David Frost?
Well, it clearly hasn't got off to a good start. My understanding is that Michael Gove and Maros Šefčovič had, as you say, a good working relationship, and they had even set up a kind of a hotline following the Article 16 affair at the end of January, whereby, you know, somebody could pick up the phone if there was something big happening or if there was a potential risk of something going wrong. And my understanding is that that simply didn't happen yesterday. There was no prior warning to Maros Šefčovič. UK officials are saying they did contact the European Commission on Tuesday, but certainly Maros Šefčovič wasn't connected or contacted directly by David Frost. And this has gone down very badly because this is clearly seen as not the way you go about things, especially since the view in the Commission is that Maros Šefčovič had been, you know, hunting high and low for pragmatic, practical solutions. He'd done outreach meetings with UK business, Northern Ireland businesses, with civil society, with the Brexit stakeholders group in Dublin. And he had proposed further meetings with supermarkets, with hauliers, with port officials. He was clearly trying to find ways to find solutions within the framework of the protocol, and then suddenly the UK announces a unilateral solo action on extending the grace period.
Is it, and briefly on this, Tony, is it too petty to think that this is Britain responding to what happened some time ago when the EU moved on Article 16 of the protocol in relation to the vaccines?
I mean, I think here it's being seen more in the context of the Internal Market Bill from last September, a pattern whereby the UK will do something unilateral and will knock everything off course, and then there's a crisis, and then in the autumn, the result of that crisis was that both sides doubled down and found an agreement in December on how to implement the protocol. And that's why people in the Commission are very sore, because they felt that the back then the Commission had taken a measured response to the Internal Market Bill, kept the talks going, and found, you know, workable solutions, which they feel have now been cast aside by the British government.
Tony, for now, thank you very much.
Now, the Duchess of Sussex has said Buckingham Palace could not expect her and Britain's Prince Harry to be silent if it was perpetuating falsehoods about us. It's part of an interview with Oprah Winfrey, which will air in the US on Sunday and in the UK on Monday. And it's expected to detail the couple's short period as working royals together before they step down for a life in the US. Buckingham Palace is now investigating claims the Duchess bullied royal staff. In a clip released by CBS this morning, Oprah Winfrey asks her, "How do you feel about the palace hearing you speak your truth today?"
"I don't know how they could expect that after all of this time, we would still just be silent if there is an active role that the firm is playing in perpetuating falsehoods about us. And if that comes with risk of losing things, I mean, there's a lot that's been lost already."
The firm, Meghan Markle, speaking to Oprah Winfrey in an interview to be aired this weekend. Johnny Diamond is royal correspondent for BBC News. Johnny, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
Do you know what else was said in the interview?
No, we don't. We're waiting to find out, because the CBS is putting out these sort of dribs and drabs, just a couple of clips so far, these teaser clips. And we understand that Harry has talked about how unbelievably tough life had been for him. We understand that there was a reference to Meghan being silenced, but that is it, because so far we've had probably a release of about 1 minute from what we understand will be a 2 hour long program. But that most recent clip that you played, that CBS put out about 3 or 4 hours ago now, is pretty explosive stuff. Two reasons. I mean, one, it's very clear we can expect fireworks. We can expect direct criticism of the royal family, which is always the big question. We were pretty sure that Meghan and Harry were going to have a go at the media. They've made clear that they loathe the British media, in particular the best-selling newspapers in Britain, who they feel they were very hard done by. But it wasn't clear whether they sort of crossed the line and criticised the royal family. Well, that makes it pretty clear they're going to. And secondly, we get a glimpse into her state of mind, their state of mind. They clearly think that the palace has been and is actively spreading, well, they use the phrase, falsehoods about them. And that is their reason for sort of letting rip. But we don't know how far that goes. Does it mean direct criticism of individual members of the family? Does it mean they're going to start telling tales out of school? It's a very good teaser clip, because it does make you think, gosh, I want to watch that.
Johnny, for those of us who haven't been keeping up, and even for those of us who have, what's the firm?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the firm. That phrase, I think, first came from Prince Philip, the Queen's husband. And that is a reference to the royal family and the machinery around it. The sort of the organization that other people refer to as the palace, the royal family, the court, whatever you want. There is some dispute as to whether it directly refers to just family members or whether it is the sort of wider palace. And again, that might seem like an unimportant point, but if you're thinking about what kind of things Meghan is talking about there, whether it means that she's going to directly talk about, I don't know, Prince William or the Queen, or whether she's just going to talk about courtiers, arguably of less interest and less damaging. We'll have to see. But yeah, the firm generally just refers to the royal family.
Before we get on to talking about these bullying claims and the timing of them, are the firm, are Buckingham Palace worried and why?
Yeah, I mean, I think Buckingham Palace is concerned about it. I mean, outwardly they say, look, we are more worried about the status of Prince Philip, the condition of Prince Philip. He's now in his third week in hospital. He's 99 years old. He's got an infection and they're worried about his heart as well. And I think that's probably top of their list of concerns. But yeah, when they're thinking about how the royal family comes across, having the couple give an interview and what's clearly a no-holds-barred interview and what is clearly going to include criticism of them, there's no way they wouldn't be concerned about it. They'll be concerned about what's said and how it is said. On the surface, however, when you talk to them, they'll say, look, we've got other things to worry about right now.
Does the timing of these bullying claims belie their concern?
Well, I mean, it's complicated on the bullying claims. You know, this is past history. This refers to stuff that was going on in 2018. And the allegations that have been made by a series of anonymous sources in the London Times is that predominantly Meghan, but also Harry, acted, in a bullying manner towards people. The allegation is that two members of staff were bullied out of their jobs by Meghan. And it has to be said that around that time, there were an awful lot of stories about Meghan, stories coming out of the palace about Meghan being, put it this way, an over-demanding boss. And, you know, a number of staff of the couple did leave. The interview itself was recorded before these allegations were made, but the sort of Sussex people, the people around them, the people who are close to them say, look at this story. It is an absolute prime example of the palace or a part of the palace briefing against the Duke and Duchess. So, you know, it's a complicated and fairly unhappy tale, a product of, you know, this being both a personal situation, a family with all of its tensions, and we all know about that, but also an official situation because of the place that these individuals occupy or occupied within the British state.
And Meghan and Harry are clearly going to deny any claims of bullying families. Johnny Diamond, thanks for speaking to us. 2 minutes to 9.